I'd like to welcome you all to the latest in our Global Health Perspectives podcast. My name is Derek Yach. I'm the president of the Foundation for a Smoke-Free World. And we've been exploring with people around the world the whole issue of health and its nexus to smoking. Today, I'm very pleased to have my friend and colleague, Vilu Marwala Patel, all the way from Bangalore to join us. I first met Vilu when I came across her as being one of the biotech innovators cited in Nature, and had to understand her work and what she was doing, and have over the years learnt an enormous amount from both the scientific acumen, the incredible courage and perseverance to move ahead in a tough field, and the commitment to improving the world. Before I get into the specifics about her work with Avestigen, Vilu, it'd be great, first of all, just to understand your background and how you got to where you are in terms of training and interest and passion.
Thanks, Derek. It's been a pleasure to know you. And you've been there. Or I know most of my journey in many ways, multiple ways. So to go back to where I began, I'm a small town girl. My parents were Parsis, and they came from Navsari and Surat, but settled in Telangana to build out a business. We were invited by the Nizam of Hyderabad, my grandfather, and we were given various areas to build upon and develop those areas, which were extremely poor. And so we were building cotton ginning mills and alcohol distilling and turmeric polishing. So we came from that kind of a background. But we always had a lot of reading at home. And at the age of six, I was dispatched to a Catholic boarding school because of lack of education in that little town of Nizamabad in Telangana. And so I grew up with Italian nuns, and it was very strange. A Parsi girl, who grew up in, whose parents work in a district of Nizamabad, and then I come down to the Italian nuns. So it was very interesting growing up 9 years in that boarding school. And we passed out through senior Cambridge, and then I went on to an undergrad again with nuns. And by 21, I was finishing my master's again with nuns in Mumbai. So I was a total convent product. And in the end, I married immediately thereafter. So I was very curious. I mean, being cloistered in convent surroundings, I really never knew what the world was like. So I was extremely curious. And having grown up from that background, there was this inherent curiosity to learn and contribute to the community, because I have seen that kind of poverty. And of course, early marriage, early motherhood, and led to an almost immediate international exposure at ICRISAT, which I joined by the age of 22, right after my master's, which opened my eyes to global science and opportunities.
Just spell out what ICRISAT is for people.
Oh, ICRISAT is International Crop Research Institute for the Semi-Arid Tropics. And I feel it's one of the cornerstones in my life. And because immediately right after master's and a new marriage, I jumped into this organization, and it opened my eyes to global science and opportunities within the scientific community, and through science achieve a better world. So also those days at ICRISAT coincided with achievements in genetic engineering worldwide. And the world was changing both politically and scientifically. It was 1989. I'd spent 10 years at ICRISAT, and the Berlin Wall was coming down. And being a sociopolitical creature, as well as very keen to get into the new field of genomics, I arrived at the lab of Professor Jacques-Henri Weil in Strasbourg, France, and ended up working on fundamentals of RNA editing, which was just discovered that time, and it was very early years of RNA work, and worked on editing and splicing. It was really cutting edge, and it was a huge learning curve for me from the doing biochemistry work at ICRISAT and to jumping into fundamental molecular biology and genetics. And I learned to cope, and it was amazing, the French experience. And that whole, maybe that were living with Italian nuns for such a long time helped me fit in. So, you know, I was quite accustomed to European culture. So I could do a good job there. And we had a fantastic life there doing my PhD. But what I gathered from that, from this work, was that all life forms are quite similar genetically. And they differ. And if we were to understand these differences that are there among individual organisms within and outside different species and taxa, one could attempt to reorganize the world and address the challenges the world faced. So that, if you look at it in a nutshell, that was the learning I got from this work.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. And I think if we jump through the decades now, you know, we are thrilled that you've completed the first Zoroastrian Parsi mitochondrion reference genome. And I think for most listeners, that would sound like a pretty scary thing to complete. And I just wonder whether you could take us through a couple of the terms. First, you did mention your background and that you are a Parsi. Maybe just why this is so significant, and you know, very briefly, the history and the importance of studying the Zoroastrian Parsi group as being a unique contribution to our world knowledge. And maybe when you're doing that, also just give us a sense of how, in many ways, it's a smaller but as equally important version of what's been happening in Iceland with deCODE.
That's right. And I think this has been a great study of self-discovery in some ways, as you say, being a Parsi myself. I was always intrigued by the migratory patterns of people and how the genomics plays out, as well as the endogamous nature of this community. And the fact that they were believers of Zarathustra, he was an ancient prophet born in the 6450 BC. And basically, what they did was they believed in the sanctity of elements, fire, water, air, earth, and sky. And fire in Zoroastrianism is considered the purest of all, and they strict measures are employed to maintain the purity of the fire, and hence the strict social ostracism practiced against smokers in the community. And the very nature of such ritualistic practices has made this a very interesting, unique population to study not only migration and endogamy, but also to study the effects of lack of smoking. And this could form a, you know, and this has continued for 1300 years in India. They arrived in India 1300 years ago. And, you know, post the, you know, once the Arabs had invaded and the Persian empires had collapsed. So since then, practicing endogamy for 1300 years with the social ritualistic practices of non-smoking and provided a baseline community for us to address, you know, cessation of smoking, because I felt a standard would be very important, a standard genome, because ultimately it's all going to be digital healthcare, and it was going to be linked to genomes. And so if we could lay down the standard and see if we could find, you know, variants, which clearly showed that practicing non-smoking habits were resulted in, you know, lower incidence of lung cancer and other cancers. So that is what was achieved by this work.
No, and I think what intrigued us in our first discussions was that there are two broad areas of learning that I think we could have for the world community. The one is how it's possible that beliefs that are shared across centuries can have such a positive impact on health behaviors, in this case, smoking, in the face of the assault of advertising and marketing and many other pressures that must have been on young Parsis growing up in communities. And despite that, they've resisted. What does that mean for how other people might use either their own beliefs, their own structures going forward? But then, as you say, the deeper issue is, what has this meant as people have passed on traits from generation to generation to generation? And I can recall you looked very early on at some of the mortality rates, and it'd be useful just to comment on what do we see if we look at lung cancer among Parsis and Parkinson's as a contrast.
Yeah, so just to say that we found in this particular piece of work that out of the 420 variants that we got, 200 and odd were linked to longevity. And that was the other aspect of the outcome, that this community lives long. I mean, that is established, while compared to the Indian population, whose average age is around 66. So this community goes on to 90, 89, 90. So there is definitely the presence of longevity. And also the diseases. I mean, we do have higher percentage of Parkinson's, which was also very much, displayed in this case. And but lower rates of lung cancer, or nil. Actually, we found the mutations, I'm just trying to bring that out, the C to A and G to T mutational signatures, which are commonly found in tobacco-associated cancers, were less than 6% in this community. While in the mitochondrial, we are referring to the mitochondrial genome here, the nuclear genomes have also been sequenced, which we are now analyzing. That will be the next add-on publication coming behind. But at the mitochondrial level, which is linked to the electron transport chain, you know, which is linked to your lungs and ATP production, you are seeing less than 6% of those tobacco-linked signatures, and absolutely nil presence of variants, which were found to be associated with the lung cancer in the 16S RNA and ND5 and ND6 genes of the mitochondrial genome.
So I know it's still early to speculate, but do you think this is going to have significance for drug development and possible interventions on the one hand for Parkinson's, given the very high rates and the signature that you have there, and secondly, maybe for better diagnostics on lung cancer?
Sure. I think that's what's going to be the outcome of this. And we also found rare disorders because of endogamy, which could also be very important for drug discovery, as well as drug discovery for lung cancer, for sure, and predictive diagnostics, which will come. Because we are also, if you remember, we are doing CF, free circulating DNA and RNA, also going along in parallel. So that is going to be very interesting too, data coming from there.
So how many Parsis are actually now living in India? I imagine the population is probably aging.
Yes, there are about 51,000, I think, less than 51,000. And overall, if you look at all the, I mean, as per the Parsi directory, which I checked, around 79,000 worldwide have been registered on the Parsi directory, which normally collects everyone's, in there. So I would say in India, around 51,000 plus, but the diaspora, which is partly on the west coast of US and the east coast, and then you have the UK and Canada and Australia, you would say another 20 to 25,000 maybe.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's quite fascinating how, studying practices that began literally centuries ago may be important both for their health and survival by giving attention to their background, but also for everybody. Obviously, I can't avoid asking how you're all doing during this coronavirus pandemic, and noting that India just passed, it's getting close to 500,000 cases, and Bangalore appears to be relatively spared at this point, but how are you all doing?
I think Bangalore took some early precautions and locked up the places, and they gave permissions to a few of our laboratory type workers to go ahead and work. So I've been working all through COVID. But yes, I think we all need to take precautions. And I think India is going to see a big, vast spread, especially around what I call manufacturing centers. So we are seeing it really there. If you look at it, it's Mumbai and it's Delhi and Ahmedabad and Chennai and Hyderabad. These are all large manufacturing populated centers. At the same time, we are seeing in Dharavi they have got control of the situation, the people who live in Dharavi, which is India's largest slum. So I think what we have to do is follow those practices of social distancing, hand washing, and all of that, and masks. But India does not, I mean, they'll have to impose this discipline in people. They don't understand discipline, I mean, I think. And so I'm worried about India at the moment that it's going to spread. We are still safe in Bangalore and Karnataka. I think it has recorded the least numbers of people infected. But last 4 days, we have seen an increase. And this is linked, I think, to the people returning back from Maharashtra and Tamil Nadu, which are highly infected places.
Yeah, and we saw those hundreds and thousands and millions of people who dashed out of the cities at the start of the pandemic. And as you say, they're now returning, and migration is a very tough issue to control.
I think so, yeah.
So Velu, let me thank you enormously and for giving us just a little insight into your work and into a community who many people don't have insights into. And I'd really urge that people look and contact us for more details at podcast@smokefreeworld.org. And we hope to track, and we're thrilled to have Velu as a partner as the science evolves. But as importantly as the science is placing the focus on the Zoroastrian Parsi community, a proud, extraordinary community with an incredible history and some great scientists, business people, actors, people in all levels of society, whose genomes now may provide answers to complex questions in the future. Please all take care. And as Velu said, if we stick to the basics, we can actually continue to hopefully hold down and reduce the impact of the pandemic. And thank you again, Velu.